Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned a BS in mathematics and chemistry and a law degree from the University of Detroit Mercy. He was an assistant prosecutor for Wayne County for 2 years, and since 1976, he's been a sole practitioner trial lawyer. A three-time author, his newest book is entitled The Fightin' Irish of Detroit, Fightin' in the Streets, Fightin' in the Courts, An American Story. He's a storyteller by trade and a trial lawyer by profession. His name, Fred Locke. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Fred Locke, who's been a trial lawyer in town for the last 41 years. Fred, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. And it's a real honor to be here. This is a great program you have. It's got a far-reaching audience, and you can do a lot of good on this radio show as you've done in the past. And I thank you for allowing me to be on your show.
Mark, let's give him a second bottle of free water over here, okay? All right, Fred. Let's start with your childhood and your mom and your dad, please.
Kind of like a profile or a history of them? Well, interesting. My mother's Irish. She was one of 10 kids, and she grew up in the wilds of Minnesota around Hibbing and Duluth and Lake Superior. And I remember asking her as a kid, I wish I grew up around Lake Superior so I could go swimming in the Great Lakes. She says, nobody swims in Lake Superior up around Hibbing. It's too cold. In the summer. She says it's too cold at all times. Tragedy brought the family to Detroit. A 17-year-old brother, Sherwood, died in a logging accident. Her father ran a boarding house for loggers, and he died in a logging accident at 17. The family came right down here to Marston and Woodward, which is a stone's throw from where we're sitting in WJR studios. And she went to Holy Rosary school down the way. And then Catholic Central started in 1928 right there at Harper and Woodward, which was Holy Rosary Parish. And my father spent a year in Catholic Central. During the Depression, everybody was destitute. He was an only child, but they could not afford to feed him. So they sent him down to live with an aunt, his mother's sister, who was married to a doctor in Dallas, Texas. He went down there and went from 135 pounds to 175 pounds as a 16-year-old within about 4 to 5 months. So they came out of poverty. They came out of the Great Depression. They're part of the greatest generation. Had very little to give their four children that they had. But they gave them the encouragement of education, and they told them, kid, we trust that you can do well. You're on your own, basically. But they provided shelter for us, and we never missed a meal, and we had some clothes to wear, and we all went to the Catholic school system, which cost them a little extra. So they were great parents. They were supportive as can be, and they told us the message of life. You can be somebody if you work hard, but get an education, kid. Don't end up like us. Father with a 9th grade education, mother with an 8th grade education.
Fred, where did you get your love for the law?
I got that in a couple different areas. I remember as a 9-year-old being pulled over by the police, and for no good reason. We were coming back from a drive-in show, my two sisters in the back, younger than me, and they were asleep, and a cop blasted through a stop sign, almost hit our car. And then he fell in behind my father, pulled my father over, and berated him in front of his family. I remember that feeling of helplessness, like, boy, if I could do something to help my father from this slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that are being inflicted upon him, I would do so. And I thought at that point in time, how do you get power? How do you get to stand up against this outrageous behavior of this police officer attacking my father? He didn't ticket him. He sent us off in silence, and there we went with our broken hearts, looking up at our father who had been assaulted verbally and emotionally by the cop. And that kind of set the seed. And there was a couple other incidents during the course of my life dealing with insurance companies in corporate America where that feeling of helplessness revisited me again. And I thought, how do you stand up to these people? How do you get equal treatment? Maybe not unlike the black community in Detroit, but that was kind of the genesis of the thought that maybe somewhere along the line I can do something and have equal footing with the power of corporate America, law enforcement, and things like that.
So you get a law degree from University of Detroit Mercy. Dennis Archer was a guest years ago, and I quote him now. He says, "The practice of law is a calling."
Yes.
What does he mean?
Well, Dennis and I used to try cases out of Recorder's Court back in the 70s, and we'd walk side by side and shoulder to shoulder. I loved him then, and grew to love him even more as I saw his career ascend. I think what he means, it's not like you can put in 8 hours and then go home and say, I've earned my living. It's like you get invested in their clients that you represent, and you get invested in their rights and invested in their story and invested in their right to be heard, and then you become their voice for them. So at the end of the day, when you get in your car and you drive home, it's not over. Your mind continues to run around the track of how do I do this case better? How do I become more verbal? How do I present it better? How do I hit the emotional chords that I would like to hit? And I think before Dennis said it, they said the law is a jealous mistress. It doesn't let you go. It just keeps coming after you and saying you can do better. You can look at it through a different set of eyes. Your analytical powers can be stronger. Your verbal persuasive powers can be stronger. I would guess that's what Dennis meant.
You're 34 years old, and you decide to become a sole practitioner trial lawyer. You had been an assistant prosecutor, etc. Then you work for Plunkett Cooney. Why and how did you become a sole practitioner?
I think I became a sole practitioner because I had total control of the way I wanted to try the cases. When you're working in the prosecutor's office, I worked for a great Irishman, Bill Cahalan. He gave us a lot of autonomy and allowed us to figure out how to try our cases and do what we'd like to do. Moved over to Plunkett Cooney, worked for a great Irishman whose picture is in my book, Bill Cooney. And I was side by side with Bill Cooney, learning how to make the transition from a ruffian in my youth to a polished trial lawyer. And with Bill Cooney and the firm, you couldn't speak on your own. You had to make sure that what you're saying on behalf of the firm is okayed. So I like the autonomy. I like the independence of being my own man, calling my own shots, and doing it in the way I thought was in the best interest of my client and in the best interest of justice. So given a guy that, kind of liked to call the shots and kind of liked to be in the charge, kind of liked to be the director, like Mark here, who's our director and our producer, I wanted to be able to call my own shots, and that's the way I did it. So I came back from California after I took the bar exam, put out a shingle, lawyer willing to work for food or money, and started off.
Our director, Mark, is saying it's time for a commercial break. So I'm Jack Rasula with Fred Locke, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Fred Locke, who in the last segment used a phrase, a polished trial lawyer. Fred, what makes a great trial lawyer?
Boy, that's a great question, because I've seen so many trial lawyers who are great, yet they're so different from one another. I've seen the stumbling ones that walk into a courtroom and can't figure out where their briefcase is, where their paper is, but the jury wants to reach out of the jury box down there and help them out and say, here, counselor, here's your papers you're looking for, here's your motion, here's your briefcase. And I've seen other ones that are erudite and have great command of the language. Albert Hatchett comes to mind. And they walk through that courtroom with great grace and great dignity. So there's all different kinds of way that you can be a great trial lawyer. But I think the common denominator, Jack, is that you connect to people. They see in you a transparency. They see you're not trying to scam somebody. You're not trying to play a game. They see in you a commitment to your client. They see in you a man of humility or a woman of humility. They see in you a person who will transparently face them, look at them, and be vulnerable with issues that they really believe in. So I think those are the emotional components that make a great trial lawyer. The rest is preparation, 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 endless, jealous mistress of the law, forcing you to learn more, get better, make your presentation finely honed and skilled.
Another common thing all those great trial lawyers have is they figure out how to relate to the director in that law room, the judges.
Yes.
What has 40-plus years in front of judges taught Fred Locke?
It's taught me a couple things. Number one, you have to understand the plight of a judge in order to be a successful trial lawyer, because you're going to be battling that judge, for the most part, on many, many things, and you have to have the courage to take that judge right on. But you have to do it in a certain way that doesn't offend him, so you keep his mind or her mind open. But what you need to do is understand the judge's plight. Here's a guy or a woman that's got to come to that courtroom every day, and he's not a gladiator. He's a arbitrator. He's an umpire. He's a referee. He's got to make decisions. So that person has got a heck of a job with a lot of stress and a lot of pressure, and then multiply that by 20 lawyers that are in that courtroom on motion day clamoring for their side of the case to be heard. Your Honor, but Your Honor, I need to be heard. You need to address my client's issues. And that gives you a feel for a judge who's under siege, a person under siege, and you say, that's got to be difficult. Once you understand that, and you can identify with the judge's emotional dilemmas of having to sit on the bench and have the wisdom of Solomon to decide these cases, now you're halfway there. The second part is, while you're fighting this judge tooth and nail to be heard, you've got to tell the judge and validate the judge's position. So when the judge tells you something that is crazy and shows you that the judge has misunderstood the whole issue, you can't say, come on, judge, wake up. Let's get with it. Get quick, man, because we've got justice here, and it needs to be served, and you got to wake up. You can't say that. Whenever the judge says something to you, you have to find a way of validating the judge by saying, Judge, you make a good point, an excellent point. It shows that your analysis is at work. But I think you may have missed something here, and if you would be so kind as allow me to show you what perhaps you may have missed and something else you may consider, I would appreciate that. Once you validate a human being, what do? They loosen up, and they say, oh, okay, and their mind opens up, and they're willing to listen to you. But you start telling the judge you missed the whole point, they're going to lock in, and you're never going to win. So that's the way I think you got to handle a judge, delicately and on balance.
Judge Fred Mester, from 82 to 2007, was a judge in the Oakland County 6th Circuit Court. An iconic man, a great man. He once told me, Socrates' definition of a great judge, Fred. Four traits. A great judge hears courteously, answers wisely, considers soberly, and decides impartially. Talk to us, if you will, a little bit about Fred Mester.
Fred and I met, His Honor, Fred Mester, and I met in 1971. I was working as a law clerk for Judge Robert E. DiMasio, his first law clerk, and Fred Mester was working in the clerk's office. Of course, Fred Mester lets everybody know he's from Central Michigan, but Fred Mester is a gentleman and a great guy, and a guy that I loved being in his courtroom, and I found great success, at least in two major cases that I was in his courtroom. But I think he's got it. I think he's got it right on as far as what a judge needs to do. I would say that a good judge, and I cover this in my book, in fact, and I covered it in depth with Frank Murphy, who was a judge in Recorder's Court, mayor of the city of Detroit, governor of the state of Michigan, ambassador to the Philippines back in the 20s. He was a U.S. attorney, and he was a United States Supreme Court justice who coined the phrase racism. And he was a dissenting opinion in the case of Karamatsu, where he says, no, you don't take loyal American citizens of Oriental Japanese origin and jail them because we have a war. This is the way America works. We're a melting pot. We have people coming from all over the globe, and they land in America. They're American citizens. Just because they're Japanese, you can't jail them. But that was a dissenting opinion. But getting back to your question about Mester, which I agree with 100%, I think if you wanted to coin a phrase to describe a good judge, it would be quick to grasp, intellectually strong, quick to grasp, but slow to decide, because decisions are based on deliberation. You just can't shoot from the hip. You got a lot of lives at stake, fortunes at stake. So quick to grasp but slow to decide is what would make a good judge. And I do cover that in my book in some detail about what makes a good judge, and a great judge, a great judge.
If you want to learn more, www.fredlauck.com. By the way, Judge Fred Mester in 2011 was inducted into the Journalism Hall of Fame at Central Michigan University.
Wow. Now, that's a... Jack, you're
that's
staying ahead
cotton.
Of me.
That's
you've always
cotton.
You've always seemed to be a half a step. You got a whole step ahead of me on
yeah,
that
yeah,
one.
Yeah. Okay. Another iconic judge. Judge Damon Keith, please.
The best. You know, I think this comes down to that... problem we're having today in America with the flag and the NFL players taking a knee to the flag. Here's the problem. White America cannot define America. And shame on white America if they think they're the only voice to define America. Take Damon Keith. Here's a black man. Black men look at that flag and it has a different expectation for them. America has a different view for them. And so when black America looks at the flag, what do they think? Do they think about the Tuskegee Airmen that fought in World War II and come back and then are told to sit in the back of the bus? See what I mean? We whiteys have to back off and we let a black man look at that flag and make a decision of what it means to him without twisting his arm. Damon Keith is a perfect example of that. Here's a kid that grew up black, grew up poor in this city, and he got lucky enough and opportunity enough to go to law school. Then he gets out of law school. What's his job? He's working over at the federal building. As a lawyer? No. As a judge? No. He's a janitor. And guys, the lawyers are coming in, and he's sweeping up the place and thinking, boy, how do I get from this level where I am to another level? And then when he does become a lawyer, they still think because he's a black man and he's a rare kind of a guy walking through the federal court system that he must be the janitor. Well, this janitor's dressing real nice now. Damon Keith was the greatest. I mean, he fought every kind of racial discrimination you could fight in this city, got through it all, and became somebody we admire and are talking about on your show, Jack.
He's got 37 honorary Doctor of Law degrees, including U of M, Yale, Georgetown.
Yeah.
Wow. In 1964, he and John Fikens were elected co-chairs of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned Damon Keith and John Fikens both in my book on the All-Star Judges. Yeah, that's a combination, and Fikens was around forever. His son is practicing law.
We're talking to Fred Lauck, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're talking to Fred Lauck, author of three books, and the latest, newest, is The Fightin' Irish of Detroit. Fighting in the streets, fighting in the courts. If you want to learn more, www.fredlauck.com. One more judge. The former Michigan Supreme Court Chief Justice, Judge Thomas Brennan. Please.
Yeah, Thomas Brennan is a Catholic Central guy, as I am. I got out in 1961. I think Judge Brennan got out in 1952. What a career he's had. I mean, he became a circuit court judge. He became a Supreme Court justice. He resigned his position on the Supreme Court to start Cooley Law School. He's a hard-nosed guy. and he's a bright guy, and he's written a book, too, which I mention in my book when I mention Tom Brennan. His classmate was Jim Ryan, who became a Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals judge, Supreme Court judge in the state of Michigan. So they were quite a combination. Brennan's still alive, still around, and still strong, and he had a son who was a judge. I got a picture of father and son all-star judges. And, of course, the Ryans are there, the Brennans are there, the Hathaways, the Rashid, and the Columbos, now the chief judge over at the Wayne County Circuit Court. So Brennan has had a heck of a run and a heck of a career, hasn't he?
Yes. In 1955, Tom Brennan ran unsuccessfully against a young man named John Dingell Jr. to fill a congressional seat held by the late John Dingell Sr., and that seat is still in the Dingell family with Debbie. Okay.
Well, that's a long run, isn't it?
As a trial lawyer these past 40 years, you've seen all of man's vices, Fred. Greed, power, theft, gluttony, hoarding. Talk about that.
Yeah, 47 years as a trial lawyer. And, Jack, I've tried all of the criminal cases there are, and I've tried all of the personal injury cases there are, and other civil cases and commercial cases. I never specialized in one area because I figure if you can effectively communicate as a trial lawyer, you can go in and you can learn various things and try these cases in various areas. But, you know, the subject you mentioned is quite interesting to me. The great historian Will Durant and his wife Ariel wrote The History of Civilization, and that was like 8-9 volumes. And when they finished, they wrote a book called The Lessons of History. What does it all mean? And the most interesting part of that book for me was when you mentioned those subjects, those taboos of human nature today, greed, gluttony, hoarding, violence even. You can throw the propensity toward violence and quick tempers, those vices of today in common times. Those were once virtues. In our evolutionary past, if you go back a million years, he who could store the most stuff and hoard the most stuff in his cave was the one that would survive. So we are the remnants of those hoarders. He who could eat the most at a given meal would have a better chance of surviving the uncertain time until the next meal. We are the survivors of those. Those people so prone to violence that would jump up in a heartbeat and vanquish their enemy and slay them. We are the leftover remnants of that evolution. So that was also a vice back in the day. And greed, that was a vice back in the day because you could hoard more and your family would survive, your tribe would survive. So we are the leftovers of all of those people, the greedy people, the violent people, the hoarders. So we still have that in our DNA, I suspect, the tendency toward greed, toward hoarding, toward violence. But those are no longer virtues, those are vices today. And I think the great prophets came along, the Moseses, the Jesus, the Mahatma Gandhis, and the Martin Luther Kings, and told us, hey, turn away from survival of your self and look toward others.
Speaking of virtues, Fred, you and I and people of our age are products of the greatest generation. And your first book was The Children of the Greatest Generation, An Emotional History. Talk to us about the greatest generation, please.
Wow. What can you say? I mean, I tip my hat to them. And Jack, you and I are fortunate because we lived with greatest generation parents. We heard from their lips to our ears at the kitchen table in the winter, at the porch in the summer, when nobody had any money to go to concerts or go to dances or to spend even going to movies. We're stuck at home, we're stuck in kitchen tables and porches, and we heard directly from their lips to our ears. So it's unfiltered. And we know the courage of that generation that fought through the Dust Bowl, that fought through World War II, that fought through the Great Depression. And that generation considered it a great success if they had enough money at the end of the week to pay the rent and feed their kids. Pensions? Automobiles? No, what are you talking about? They were not materialistic people at all. Survival for them was the name of the game. Whereas our generation not only survived, we got educated and we're able to put money in pension plans, and we're able to build houses. which are much bigger than those little bungalows we grew up in with two bedrooms and five kids. So I cannot do anything but tip my hat to the Greatest Generation. And it was my, I know Brokaw wrote about the Greatest Generation, so I picked up in my first book where he left off, and I wrote about who are their children, those influenced by Greatest Generation parents day in and day out.
We're talking to Fred Locke, who's a storyteller and also a trial lawyer. Fred, for 47 years, you've been an advocate for the underdog. And the late, great Eleanor Jositis was another advocate with Father Cunningham. And in 2000, she wrote me a letter about her philosophy of life. Here it is. I'm a firm believer that every person, no matter what their status in life, want the same thing, to be loved, understood, and appreciated. It makes no difference what our skin color, religious beliefs, or national origin, we want to be loved. To make the world a better place, we all have to understand our brothers and sisters and appreciate our differences and celebrate our sameness. Tell us about Eleanor Jositis, please.
Great lady. Father Cunningham, great man. Somebody has recently wrote a book. One of the Free Press writers who has retired has written a book, and he presented it to the Irish lawyers about 6 months ago, and it was very, very interesting. And he touched upon the relationship of Eleanor Jositis and Father Cunningham. Both great people. And as my father would say, if you ask yourself, am I happy? You're doomed to defeat. You're never going to be happy because the focus is on yourself. If you want to reach a point of happiness in life, focus on others, others' needs, and fulfill others' needs, and help out where you can. Mother Teresa, Eleanor Jositis, and Father Cunningham, Father Solanus Casey, who's going to be beatified, Father Clement Kern down here at Holy Rosary, always focusing on the other person and how to help. And the love concept, that's a very interesting concept. It comes right out of, you know, before Jesus. It comes right out of Jesus, too. But the concept of love, how do you love? And in the court system, as I had mentioned previously, the best way to show somebody that you appreciate them, you love them, and you understand them is to validate their beliefs. Validate them as a person. So when I told the judge, that's a very interesting point you mentioned there. You put a lot of an analytical thought into it, but would you consider? I have validated him. I've showed him understanding, appreciation, and I've showed him love, as Eleanor Jositis talks about it, and now his mind will open up to me. So I think that any time you can validate another human being, you're walking in the right direction, spiritually, emotionally, and every other which way a human being can look at life. Validate, validate, validate. Of course, you can't do it all the time. Sometimes people are going down the wrong path, at least in your judgment, especially children. You can't validate certain behavior. But any time you have an excuse to validate another human being, that is showing them love.
We're talking to Fred Locke, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Fred Locke, who in 2012 was recognized as the Michigan Bar State Champion of Justice. Fred, talk to us, if you will, about juries and their value to America.
Oh, you cannot underestimate the value of jurors. These are common folks coming off of their occupations and out of their homes to sit in judgment of their fellow human beings. Here's the problem if you don't have jurors. The judges can tend to become elitist. The judges can tend to become identified with the sources of power and wealth in this country. So that if you have a case and you're trying a case in front of a judge, well-intentioned people could be identifying with corporate America and against the voice of the people you represent. So you need to have jurors because they uncompromisingly try to do the right thing, and there's no lobbyist whispering in their ear about what their verdict should be or paying them money for their verdict like there is in the legislative branch of the government, filling their coffers with money. So jurors are essential to justice. If we don't have a jury system, it's going to be the rich and powerful doing what they want to the rest of us with impunity, without stop. And I cannot emphasize or underscore enough. Take away the system of trial by jury in criminal or civil cases in America, and America ceases to exist, and the rich and powerful will not be held accountable to the rest of us.
Your latest book is The Fightin' Irish of Detroit, Fightin' in the Streets, Fightin' in the Courts, An American Story. What's the basic message you hope we take from that book?
The basic message I want to give is I want to reflect by looking over my shoulder at all of those great men and women who have been trial lawyers over the course of the last 100 years, going all the way back to Frank Murphy. So that's a message of how did they do it, who were they, and what went on. Another message I would like to have the book resolve is giving you further insight into constitutional democracy in America, into capitalism, and into the ritual of trial by jury. I think you will come away after you've read the book much more informed about the American system of justice, and hopefully be entertained, because I want you to cry all your tears and I want you to laugh all your laughter with the stories I relate in the book.
One topic that I'd like to ask you about in the book is the art of confrontation and cross-examination.
One of my favorites. You know, not everybody's meant to be a trial lawyer, and there's many people practicing law who make a great living and also impact lives in other areas than being a trial lawyer. But if you're thinking about being a trial lawyer, you got to be a person that's comfortable with confrontation. In my high school aptitude test at Catholic Central my junior year, they told me, Fred, what do you want to be? I said, I want to be a trial lawyer, Father Stoba. And Father Stoba said, not a good idea for you, because your test shows an aptitude that you're too confrontational of a guy to be a trial lawyer. Well, I guess the thinking in the 1950s and the 60s was lawyers are simply people who solve problems, and they're very kind, sweet people to get together and try to figure out how to better mankind. But that's not the thinking today. If you're going to be a trial lawyer, and you got to take on and you got to confront the police, the state police, the government, and corporate America, you better be confrontational, because they'll run you right out of the courtroom and you won't have a chance and your voice won't be heard. Confrontation is the name of the game, and as soon as my opposing counsel calls me, I know he's not my friend. He's my enemy. He wants to make a good living and he wants me to lose and my client to lose. That's the adversarial process.
Your second book was Wealth, Power, Politics, and Jesus. What's the message of that book?
Well, that was me trying to figure out what does it all mean after all these years of Catholic education. I'm not a theologian, and I don't know anything about resurrections, and I don't know anything about dying for sins on crosses. But I do know that this man, this carpenter, this simple man, was a mouthy guy, kind of like I am, and he fought for the what he believed were the rights of the poor and the downtrodden, and he fought against the most powerful religion of his time, the Jewish religion, and it cost him his life. And the Romans were obviously involved too. So that man had a message, and that message was not palatable to the powers of his time, and it cost him his life. So I wanted to find out, what is the message from this man? Take away all of the theology of it, just give me the message and what is left. And how does wealth, power, and politics of today live up to that message? So that was the concept behind that book.
Chapter 5 of that book, Worshiping Wealth, the Great American Superhero.
Yeah. Well, it happened in the 80s, as far as I can tell, Jack. I mean, when I saw The Greatest Generation, nobody worshipped wealth. Everybody said they were successful if they paid enough on the mortgage to keep the house, and they were able to feed their kids and buy them a shirt and a pair of pants. That was it. That was all you needed. Wealth was not emphasized. In the 1980s came along a bunch of Wall Street guys, arbitragers, putting companies together, taking companies apart, taking control of companies, and then figuring out how to buy low and sell high. And they didn't do anything. They didn't cure cancer. They didn't help with mental illness. They didn't help with society. They didn't help promote that message of Jesus. They did nothing but line their pockets. The doctors were rich once upon a time as I was growing up. Then the trial lawyers became the people who seemed to be making a lot of money in the personal injury business. And then in the 80s, it was corporate America's and CEOs that seemed to take the top. And when they did, I question, what have you done for society? Have you just arbitraged companies? Have you just bought low and sold high on Wall Street? And if you've done just that, you've done nothing for society. But in the 1980s, I saw the accountants take over the world, and the bottom line was always the bottom line. How do you make it bigger? And if we got to cut people from their employment, let's cut them loose, because the bottom line is all that counts, and wealth is worshipped. Starting in the 1980s, and we've been on a downhill slide with that ever since, in my judgment. That's why Eleanor Jositis, Father Cunningham, Father Clement Kern, Solanus Casey, and all the rest of those are my heroes, because it's not about wealth. It's about what Eleanor Jositis says, love.
How well did you love? That's, I think, the basic question we have to answer when we meet our Maker.
Yes.
All right. As our time winds down together this evening, Fred Locke, what advice would you give our young listeners?
I've thought about that, and I think that I'd give them the same advice I give when I teach in the high schools, and that is this. When I did my aptitude test, it came out way too confrontational to be a trial lawyer. And then when I did my IQ test, it turned out that I was a star to the extent I was number two in my class, and my IQ did not support it because my IQ was in a dull normal range. That rebuff, that rejection told me determination was the only thing that would save me. So for those kids out there who are thinking about doing something with their lives, or for parents who are going to encourage kids to do something with their lives, I think the important thing is this. Every time I sit down to try a case, every time I sit down to cross-examine a new expert, an accounting, a medical expert, a construction expert, a finance expert, I feel inadequate. I don't feel up to the job. And maybe it's that dull normal IQ that I was visited with in high school that makes me feel that way. But I do not feel like I can do it. I feel like I'm overwhelmed. But I know from my past history, determination is more important than the gift of intellect. So if I stay with this, I will beat those with the gift of intellect. So kids, when you sit down and you're overwhelmed with your schoolwork, so am I, and so was I. Don't give up. Do not give up and let somebody else define you. Stay with it.
Fred Locke, thanks much for not giving up these past 47 years. Keep fighting for us common folk.
Thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure being here.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.